Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. After yet another killing of a black American at the hands of the police, what's happening with police reform? Let's get to the bottom line. The family of Tyre Nichols was present at the State of the Union address when President Joe Biden asked Congress once again to, quote, finish the job of police reform. When 29-year-old Tyre was stopped by police last month in Memphis, Tennessee, what was supposed to be a routine traffic stop escalated into a brutal beating. After being tased, he tried to run unarmed to the house where his mother was, calling out to her. It was heartbreaking. Some officers had him restrained while others were still punching him and boasted about it on video. It was so severe that Tyre had to be taken to the hospital where he died 3 days later. The officers on the scene have been fired and charged with murder. But the killing, like the murder of George Floyd almost 3 years ago, begs the question, is it just a few bad apples on the police force or a system full of institutional and cultural failures? Today, we're talking with Thad Johnson, a former police officer in Memphis, who now teaches criminology at Georgia State University and is a senior fellow at the Council on Criminal Justice. Thad, thank you so much for joining us. As I was mentioning to you earlier, this topic is one that I feel like we need to talk about, we need to address. We should be talking about it all the time, not just when we have a horrific accident or incident that has happened like now. But let me ask you, do you have any confidence that these moments of real horror out there are leading us in any real direction towards genuine police reform?
So thank you for having me. And that's a wonderful question. I do believe that these signatory events have impacted how we think about reform, but also the need for reform. So for instance, with George Floyd, the one thing that I felt was there was a racial reckoning in the U.S. I think for far too long, people believe that black and marginalized communities have been calling wolf when it comes to the police, because oftentimes outside communities don't experience what we tend to experience in our neighborhoods and with our ordeals with the police, or the feelings of fear and trauma that comes across in these interactions. And so what I have seen is that for Congress to move, local governments have moved, state governments have moved, even in the absence of the federal government passing the George Floyd Act. And so we've seen a multitude of reforms. 300 to 400 reforms have passed at the local and state level since George Floyd's death. With Tyre Nichols' death, I think what it brought up was about pretextual stops, unnecessary stops and arrests. Why do black people resist? What about these specialized units? And so we're becoming more intelligent about how we think about reform. I will say that we had calls for defund the police after George Floyd, and we saw America come through with education, educating themselves and understanding. When the crime rates went up, we realized that we do have a role for police. But I think the main thing that has happened is, what is the role of the police? And are we asking too much of our police officers? And are we making enough investments, not just in policing, but in criminal justice? And so I think we're taking a much more broader, but also deeper approach to understanding what's going on with policing and how this system works.
You know, the unit that these police officers who murdered Tyre Nichols, allegedly, who were fired by the Memphis Police Department, were part of a unit called the Scorpions. Scorpions, folks, stands for Street Crime Operations for Restoring Peace. What has happened in police departments from your perspective on the restoring and preserving peace part of the equation?
You know, and thank you for bringing up the name of the unit, Scorpion. I think far too often in policing, we take for granted what names mean, what symbols mean, what the uniform means. And research shows that these things matter. And so first, I want to say that naming a unit Scorpion unit does not evoke the Guardian style of mindset that we talked about in 21st policing. It carries on that warrior mentality that's gotten policing in trouble for far too long. And let me set the record straight. A lot of these units are performing correctly. A lot of these units have seen great impacts. And a lot of these units have impacted crime that they're targeting without taking the broken windows approach or the stop and frisk approach or the pretextual approach. Many of these units are using intelligence. They're data-driven. And many of these units also have better supervision. I think a lot of things that we saw with Memphis and the Tyre Nichols case was that we saw officers who were incompetent, officers who were obviously not adequately trained. We saw a subculture within the unit, which could be part of a broader subculture or specific to that, but we also saw a lack of oversight and accountability. And we also saw that that was most disturbing about this particular unit and Tyrese Nichols' case is that the fact that they thought that this was real policing. And this goes to how we evaluate and promote officers to these units. You know, we have to look at policing as an industry. And many of the things that we do to reform other industries can be used in policing. And I think that, yes, we need to look at these specialized units. But just like when we started talking about defund the police and the emotional aftermath, we need to take a look back and really see what's the purpose of these units. What's the purpose of and how do we suppress crime? Are we trying to suppress crime for the long term so our grandkids don't have to deal with this? Or are we just trying to get fleeting gains to get political points or for officers trying to move up their pathway up the ranks?
One of the things that struck me about the Tyrese Nichols case is that the police in this case happen to be black. Are there mistakes that we're making in racializing some of our discussions about the problems in policing today?
Absolutely. You know, and there are no such thing as a magic bullet when it comes to policing. Oh, we get more women. We get more black officers. We get more college educated officers. And you have to really make sure that you understand what you're doing. You know, oftentimes when there's an interaction between police and citizens, it's less about the race of the officer and more about the race of the citizens that's being impacted. And what I mean is nobody, black, white, green, purple, blue, whatever, is immune from anti-black messaging, that these fears of black men in particularly, these patriarchal values that we have in the U.S. that impacts black women much differently than it does black men. And has harmful effects in many other marginalized groups. And so let's talk about the black resistance and black fear. You know, as a police officer wearing a uniform on the way home, I was pulled over before. And my heart was racing fast. My mother had that same talk with me. And I was raised to respect police, not because you necessarily have the best relationship and respect the profession, but my mother didn't want me to end up on the news. And so you train kids in this way, black kids in these ways in these communities. I think what it does, it informs them, but it also sets them up for the additional anticipation. And so we have to try to find the balance and talk about these things responsibly. Fight, flight, or freeze are three known responses when it comes to fear of crime. Police see an additional resistance in black communities in dealing with black citizens. It's not because they're more criminal. It's not because they despise the police. Research shows that in many black communities, they want more policing. They just want to be treated fairly and respect and be treated humanely. But that fear can cause you to tense up. That fear can cause these things to be somewhat exaggerated, but it comes from a real place. It's historical. And many times we see these videos, it also causes and raises that fear level. And so oftentimes in many of the cases, you've seen resistance. And the one thing that really irks me, people always ask, well, if black people don't want to be killed or hurt by the police, they should comply. Well, it's not just that simple, and there's truth in that, but there's no trust right there. The trust has been eroded. And if you saw with Mr. Nichols, he was trying to de-escalate the conflict. When he got up and ran, I surmised that he was running for his life. And many other times we've seen these instances happen where these people are running for their lives because they're afraid. People think black resistance results because of defiance. Often it's because of desperation and fear and from the trauma, either vicariously or personally with these relationships. And so it also goes to show that we have some systemic issues that often impact the transaction between police and citizens.
I think the big thing we're talking about is do you need to tear down these departments down to the floor and build them back? Or is there an incremental, you know, we can tweak our way through these problems? I mean, do we need to overhaul the system, or are there reforms that can come in and kind of become antigens in the system and begin changing it? So I'd love to get your insights on that, given your experience in both sides of the equation.
Oh, that's a great question. And oftentimes when I'm talking, I use the term we, and oftentimes we refers to the black community and we refers to law enforcement. And so I often say that my wife calls me a walking paradox because I understand that many of these officers are very good people. Many of these officers want to do right, and they want to serve the public in a safe and just manner. Now, oftentimes we think this behavior happens in a vacuum, and it doesn't. It's policy, it's training, it's leadership, and not just departmental leadership, it's also the city level leadership. And we have to hold our city level leaders accountable, as well as police chiefs, because we often make police officers the scapegoat. Well, I'll tell you right now, most police officers, their behavior aligns with policy and culture. And you can have all the policies that you want, but if you don't enforce them, that sends a message for culture. I will also say many times, you know, people have been disappointed in the federal government. I don't think it's earth-shattering or the end of the day, because at the end of the day, reform starts with the local level, with police and the community that they're serving, a local government. And so, yes, many places have come out with great things, like the Council on Criminal Justice. Our task force came with recommendations like increased data collection, duty to intervene, trauma-informed approaches, national training standards, the certification registries. All of these things are vitally important, because we have to think about police reform over the long term. We in our generation may not see the full benefits of it. It may be our grandkids that are actually able to do it, but we have to be in it for the long haul. I'll get into some details, but we've seen places like Cincinnati who made changes, yes, because of federal input, but they made changes and they took it and ran with it. And as long as they had the political will, we saw improvements. But once they moved away from that reform about 7 to 10 years later, things started going back on the downside and where they were before they made these reforms. And so it shows that reform has to be sustained and it can't be a flash in the pan. So a couple of things is this: how we select officers. Everybody wants to hire college educated officers, but you have to pay them. So we can't defund the police if we want to hire the best top quality officers. Research shows that the higher paying jobs recruit and attract and retain more a superior workforce. The same thing goes for policing. Also training, you know, the basic training, in-service training, we have to take it seriously and make sure it aligns with 21st century policing. Our leaders, are they trained? Are they competent? How were they presented? What were their background checks? What was promotion pathway? What is their record looks like? So, do they hold their officers accountable? So it's these things. And so I will say that it's a lot. But yeah, there's several things agencies can do right now.
Well, let me jump in here. I want you to keep going on it, because I want to ask you a question. Kenneth Corey, who's a former police chief of New York City, has said that what we ask of our cops is that they think like lawyers, speak like psychologists, and perform like athletes, but we pay them as common laborers, which is exactly the point you're making. And the question is, do you have any insights into the prescription that might address this problem of the seeming mismatch of skills and training with what we and the pay that we're paying officers?
If we want better officers, we have to make investments in our police force. You know, let me just say this: about 80 to 90% of all police department expenditures go towards salaries and benefits. They're not rolling over in the dough. And so this is oftentimes we saw the militarization of police, and why are police departments clamoring toward these monies and these equipments? Because they are thirsty for more resources and better resources. You also have a manpower issue. And so, we need to train better. Yes, we need to do these things. But remember, I told you, police departments, police officers are policy compliant, and their behavior didn't happen in the vacuum cleaner. We've seen that many of these cases have spurred out of unnecessary contacts with police officers, not treating citizens fairly, not explaining to them what was going on, not evoking procedural justice. So a lot of it goes with that. And why do police officers respond so aggressively? Why do police officers chase down arrests and citations, oftentimes those without any public safety value? The police reward structure. And so, speaking of pay, we have to understand that how police are promoted and advanced weighs heavily on those quote unquote invisible quotas that nobody wants to talk about. And so those are only about 10 to 15% of the job. And so right there, hiring better quality officers, better training, that's going to take time, because you're just not getting rid of officers without due process. But in the meantime, you can change how we interact with citizens. If we spend 85% of our job community building and other interactions that's not engaging lawbreakers and just law-abiding citizens, why not reward officers for that? We wonder, why hasn't community policing taken off? It's been around forever. It's not a new concept. But we have not aligned our reward structures, incentive and promotion structures, with how the public needs to be served to keep up with 21st century policing. And so oftentimes with how we reward police officers, we put officers and citizens in adversarial confrontations unnecessarily. And remember that fear, that black fear of police. You throw that into these things, and police officers who are not trained for 21st century policing, they're still trained like you're being trained in the old guard regime. You can see how conflict can come together. I mean, research shows that Black people don't want to be put police less, any less. Oftentimes it shows that they want the same amount or more policing. But remember, it's how they're approached and how they're dealt with. And the last thing I'll say, you know, you asked the question earlier, should we overhaul the complete system? Let me give some stats. Oftentimes we focus on the use of force and police killings. Some of those things are legally justified. And I'm not saying that they're not lawful, but awful. But we need to prevent those things from escalating, preventing that trigger. But remember this, 1,200 people were killed by police officers on average the past couple of years. On average, the police have 50 or 60 million contacts with citizens. And so that means that less than 0.002% of all cases result in death. In the city of Memphis, you saw 800 calls of service each year in 21 and 22. They reported about 1,200 useless force reports. Now, say they don't report everything. Even if it was double that, and say it was actually 2,500 use of force incidents that happened, or divided by 800,000, that's still less than 1%. And so I think a major issue is the use of force, but we need to understand, is it reasonable? And then how do we prevent that? Remove the pretext out of policing and reward officers for the job that they want. Why do you think we don't have many women supervisors? Why isn't it attracted to women and other marginalized and non-white groups? Because right. Research shows that the type of policing that I'm talking about is policing that they're actually attracted to,
right.
Not this old guard. And so I'll just shut up on that, yes.
No, I think it's important. And look, I really liked at the beginning of our conversation that you mentioned that there are departments out there that are data-driven, that are paying attention to feedback, you know, responding to it, figuring out how they're improving. I'm also a data guy, and so one of the data points that has come out of the, you know, Memphis police training manuals is that they spend about 208 hours, believe it or not, on firearms training and about 10 hours on conflict resolution de-escalation. Does that have to shift from your perspective?
That's part of it, right? Because I remember going through the same academy and I could fight, I could run, I could drive, I knew the law, I had great survival tactics, I could shoot, but I didn't receive much training de-escalation or dealing with special populations. How do I deal with juveniles? How do I deal with someone who's having a mental episode? How do I deal with these things? And you leave the academy thinking you're going to fight a foreign adversary every day instead of your community member. So I think, you know, that warrior mentality, that us versus them, is pervasive in the academy. And so this is why I even say that it's deeper than who you hire. Some people say that if you hire college educated officers, they bring certain skill sets in, but depending on their training, and not just basic training, they're field training officer. Mm-hmm. They're in-service training, which is more repetitive. The reward structure can really dictate on how they police, and they can become tainted by all of those things and what they came into the force for.
Right.
They realize to keep their jobs, to pay their bills, to take care of the kids and all these things that the job requires other things. And so there's a mismatch in what we're saying we want to do
right.
and how we're training and how we're rewarding.
I watched President Biden's State of the Union address. I guess about 20 million other Americans did, and he acknowledged Tyre Nichols' parents up in the viewing gallery, and said to Congress, "Finish the job and pass the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act." Here's the thing that I'm struggling with. Let's imagine, and I have to say, I don't think it'll pass. From what I see in Congress today, I don't think that Policing Act is going to pass. So I just put my cards on the table. But if it did pass, would it solve this underlying problem? Are we, again, talking about the wrong thing, distracted by the wrong thing? Give us your final thoughts here.
I mean, absolutely. Everybody was up in arms. And I was like, well, for me, police departments, nonprofits, local governments are working together for a holistic approach. Places like Fayetteville, North Carolina, places like Camden and Newark, New Jersey, places like Dallas and Denver with the STARS program, San Francisco, who provides immunity to sex industry workers and those who are undocumented immigrants so they can report their victimization and not worry about being charged criminally, right? Many places have taken this trauma-informed approach. And so for me, the federal government can set guidelines on all those things. Like the executive order was great, but it was only for federal officers. That's a minor amount of contact that people have with federal officers. And so for me, I see the federal government providing minimal thresholds. Like, I think qualified immunity or making changes to it is great, but it's not the end of the world. That's only financially. Police officers are not rolling over in the dough. Now, we want to hold people accountable like Derek Chauvin. Kim Potter and these others, you want to hold them accountable criminally, that has nothing to do with qualified immunity. And so the federal government is well positioned. You want more data? Help agencies get the infrastructure, the computing power, the manpower and personnel that specialize in understanding, analyzing data. Most times these smaller agencies just pull a guy off the beat and say, hey, you know computers, can you input these data? Of course there are going to be issues. And so the federal government can be a financer of reform by setting these things up. And many reforms are already taking place. Like, for instance, the Dallas Stars program partners police officers with social workers and other service providers. Great benefits, but they had to fight for funding even though they showed these benefits and had a proven track record. And so that's where I see the federal government stepping in, providing the right equipment for these agencies, bolstering the pay so we can make sure we get the best and brightest officers that we seek of. So I see the federal government playing that role. So those things provide a baseline, like banning chokeholds, right, no-knock warrants, these types of things. They provide a baseline for the reform that we need. But until we create pathways for officers who are service-minded, who are community-oriented to be leaders, and you keep focusing on reward structures that have no public safety value and with those criminality metrics, you're going to have people who value warrior-style policing continue to be the gatekeepers as supervisors are being promoted, and those who are more attracted to innovative, community-building type of policing, they're going to go for other careers and not deal with this. And so I think it's so important that we not get blinded by big bills and all these things at the federal level. It's a state level. It's a local matter, and the federal government can partner and help them with this. And this is the last thing I'll say. You know, oftentimes we put the federal government as these innovators. But from our research with the 1994 crime bill and other things, the federal government rewards and signs things into play and many times has already been done at the state and the local level. And so this is not the one time they should deviate away from that, because the answers are there. And so I think, you know, let's not get caught up in that. That's not the biggest deal in the world. But there are other things the federal government can do, can support efforts that are going on already. And the last thing is, that means supporting things more than police reform. We can't arrest our way out of these issues. We also need to make sure that we build up our communities.
Right.
Make sure that we address some of the systemic issues that I talk about that leads to more resistance between police officers and citizens, and Black citizens in particular. And so I think those are some places where we can really gain traction in the interim while we make these other infrastructural changes. And so for me, that's the role of the federal government at this point, regardless of the George Floyd Act. That's a great, it's symbolic, but substantively, I'm not sure how much is going to change the lives of people on the ground between police and communities being over-policed.
Powerful discussion. Senior fellow at the Council on Criminal Justice and former policeman Thad Johnson, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been my pleasure.
So what's the bottom line? It's not about defunding the police. And of course, there are fearless cops out there who save people every day. But to deal with abuse, it's definitely time to stop talking and start doing, in the words of the former Republican governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie. It may surprise you, but 10 years ago, he totally dismantled the police force of one city, Camden, New Jersey, and rebuilt it. And now it's a model of how a modern police force should work. What happened to Tyre Nichols is not an anomaly, and the problem is not going away by itself. The job is left to the thousands of local communities across America to figure out their own ways to protect themselves against criminals without becoming criminals themselves. And that's the bottom line.